Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Mike from Lansdale.
Evening, everybody. My name is Michael, and I'm an alcoholic. You know how they say, like, when you're nervous, you just picture the crowd naked? That's not working. A couple months ago, I was asked to share my message with everybody. And it's funny, from the moment he asked me to do it, I thought about it every day. You know, and up until probably a few hours ago, I realized that as long as I don't share my message, everything will be just fine. You know, what I can give you and what I will give you is the message that was given to me by my sponsor and the one that was passed down to him and so on and so forth, you know. Part of a legacy of Alcoholics Anonymous, one that's been saving lives for a very long time, you know, mine included. Pardon my raspy voice, I'm a little sick these days. Perfect timing. But anyway, I was born and raised in South Philadelphia, and I had a pretty normal childhood for that neighborhood, you know, in the time I grew up. I had an Irish father, Italian mother, grew up in the Italian section. Roman Catholic. We grew up kind of poor, but I was the last one to actually know that. You know, everything was normal, quote unquote, or at least so I thought, you know. I come from a line of alcoholics. It's pretty safe to say that. You know, I have family members that have died from cirrhosis. I have family members that have died from drug addiction, alcoholism, you know, and I just seem to follow in stride. You know, I can tell you that my entire life, I've always lived with good intentions. You know, like I never planned on becoming an alcoholic. I never planned on going to jails and institutions. I had never planned on keeping my parents up at night worrying and wondering where their son was. I had never planned on dropping out of school and getting in trouble. And, you know, that list can continue on for more than the time that I've been given to speak. You know, I always had good intentions, but for some reason or another, they never seemed to pan out. You know, after being sober for a little while and sitting down with my sponsor and going through the big book and the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I started to see a lot of those patterns. You know, I started to see the causes and conditions, you know, and the reasons why my life had been that way. You know, the big book describes an alcoholic as self-centered to the extreme. You know, egocentric. That was me. You know, I never really cared about anybody else. I thought I did, you know, but if I genuinely cared about other people, I wouldn't have done those things, you know. But I didn't start drinking until I was about 13 years old. And even then, I could honestly say it was an innocent, childish thing, you know, that I started. It was me and a bunch of my friends hanging on the street corner, you know, playing basketball, and at nighttime, we'd buy quarts of beer and hang out, you know. And I didn't like the taste of beer when I was a kid. I honestly didn't. But the camaraderie that came with it was something that I had been looking for, you know. I felt at peace, at ease, when it was just me and the fellas sitting around telling stories, lying to each other about girls that we never dated and knew, you know, things like that. And but when no one was looking most of the time, I would dump most of my court out because I didn't like the taste. I just enjoyed the atmosphere, so to speak, you know, and the feelings that came with it. But in time, slowly but surely, I would dump out a little less and drink a little more. And I started to finally realize what all the rest of the guys were going through and the reasons that they were smiling and having a good old time. And I fell in love with being drunk. You know, I did. I fell in love with the feeling of being drunk. You know, alcohol gave me, you know, when I was a kid, you know, today I stand here 6'5", about 240. When I was a kid, I was very short and a lot more chubbier than I am today. You know, and I always felt a little awkward, you know, but when I was drunk, I was the cat's meow. You know, I wasn't afraid of anything. You know, I wasn't afraid to talk to people. I wasn't afraid to act the way that I wanted to act. It gave me the confidence that I had thought I had been lacking, you know, in all types of aspects of my life. But as innocent as it started at such an early age, very quickly did it become far from innocent. I stand by this belief. You know, going through, everyone in this room remembers what it's like, or at least I hope, remember what it's like being a teenager and going through those years. And there are a lot of changes that develop in a man or a woman's life in that time. You know, and when you add alcohol, things become askew, we'll say. And that's what happened to me. Very quickly, I became more than a potential young alcoholic. I wouldn't say that I became an alcoholic just yet, but I was surely set aside from the average temperate drinker, you know, even at an early age. Between the ages of 14 and 17, I frequented many juvenile institutions, you know, whether it was juvenile penitentiaries or asylums or dual diagnosis centers or however you'd like to call it. I was in many of them, you know, because now looking back, I know that I had a problem with drinking and drugs. And in passing, I will mention, not only am I allergic to alcohol, I am also allergic to alcohol in any form. I'm allergic to certain herbs. I'm allergic to certain powders. I'm allergic to certain pills and so on and so on. You know, but later on I found out I'm allergic to pretty much anything that takes me out of me. You know, I like more. But everybody used to say, I remember growing up, I'd see a psychiatrist or a doctor, and the magic words would always come up. He's bipolar. You know, he's chemically imbalanced. Today I believe I was chemically imbalanced because there were many, many chemicals in my system when I saw these people. You know, but as far as being bipolar, I'm not real sure about that. But finally, you know, I met a woman who for some strange reason actually cared. You know, of all the people that I met that would just sign me off to another doctor or put me into another facility, this woman genuinely cared for reasons that I do not know. And she put me in a facility in Montgomery County. And they found out that, yeah, I may be a little off, but I had an alcohol addiction and a drug addiction as well. You know, I was 17 at the time, and forgive me, I don't really talk much about my war stories because they're mine, and everyone in this room has their own, and there's no sense in really rehashing any of those. You know, my pain is my pain, and I'm sure it's not so different than yours. You know, but by the time I was 17, I was living up here. They finally let me out of where was I at that time? Northwestern. And by this time, my parents had divorced, and I moved in with my mother. And I had no intention of staying sober, none whatsoever. But I didn't know anybody, and I didn't have a car or a driver's license. And it's not like Philadelphia up here where you can just walk around, you know, and meet people. You know, I tell a story often that the first time I went to go get a pack of cigarettes, I chose the wrong direction to walk in. And I must have walked 3-4 miles thinking that there's got to be a store coming up here sooner or later. And there just wasn't. But so instead of drinking, I got a job not too far from my mother's apartment. I was a short order cook. And I remember when I first moved up here, I had a very thick South Philadelphia accent. You know, and all the young girls found that very fascinating. You know, so I used that to my advantage. And I remember one day I'm sitting in the diner and I am lying through my teeth pretending to be this guy that I'm not to all the little waitresses, you know. And my boss comes in and just starts to belittle the ever-living hell out of me in front of everybody, you know. And he pulls me aside and he says, you know, I used to be just like you, a young punk. And he had very colorful things to add to that. And he said, but then I got sober. And he started, I don't know why. But he started to talk to me about his life and how he had found AA, or actually AA had found him. And at the end of the conversation, he asked me if I wanted to go to a meeting. And because I had no friends and nothing to do, I said, sure. And I remember the first meeting I went to was at the Lansdale Clubhouse. This was back when it was behind the 7-Eleven in the heart of Lansdale. And it was a men's meeting. It was a Friday night, 6 o'clock men's meeting. And I walked in, and I was young. I was 17, you know. And I walked in, and I was the youngest person in the room by a significant amount of years. There were more tattoos in the room than people. There were less teeth in the room than people. And, I was scared. I can genuinely say that. I was very nervous and scared because I was out of my element. You know, I was used to being able to lie and manipulate my way in or out of many situations. But these men actually, you know, they scared me because they saw right through me. So I didn't really speak much, you know. And at the end of the meeting, which I got nothing out of because I couldn't focus on anything, my soon-to-be future sponsor, Steve Mannucci, I can say his name because he's passed away since then, and he died sober, I might add. But he said, "What'd you think?" I said, "It was all right." He goes, "You want to come back next week?" I said, "Sure." And the only reason why I kept coming back was because at the end of the meeting, we went out to dinner. You know, and everybody kind of hung out. And that was something I think back then that I needed, some type of camaraderie. You know, later on I found out that's what we call the fellowship of AA. Not the program, but the fellowship of AA. And I kept coming back. Unfortunately, I can sum up 7 years of not drinking with those words. I kept coming back. Now, I am a living testament that those things that you hear in AA about don't drink and go to meetings do not work. You know, if you are an alcoholic, like I am an alcoholic, if you are an alcoholic of the hopeless variety, just not drinking and going to meetings will kill you. You know, I have seen many people try to do it. I've seen many people die from it. I have seen many people try to do it, and I've seen many people go back into the grips of insanity. You know, and for some strange reason, I had a chance to come back. Now, like I said, it was about 7 years that I did that, and I treated AA, the rooms of AA, the fellowship. I can't say the program because I never tried it, but everything else about AA, like anything else that I had in my life. You know, like a bar, actually. I came and went as I wanted. I lied and cheated and manipulated. I became a better womanizer in there because it's a very condensed micro-society that we have in AA. You know, I basically committed every sin that you could possibly think of in AA, and I suffered the consequences for it. Now, it wasn't all that bad because through osmosis and just coming around, some things did sink in. I found myself able to actually pass on the message, even though I had no idea what it meant. You know, I would come to a meeting, I would hear what you had to say, I would go to another meeting and repeat it. And I would love doing that because I would have people come up to me and say, "You sound so good." You know, one fella actually came up to me and said, "You are wise beyond your years." And I remember thinking things like, "You're damn right I am." You know, very cocky and self-centered, you know. But I never did any of the things that I spoke of. I never practiced what I preached. You know, I would just come to meetings and fit the bill, which is much like I did in the rest of with the rest of my life. I'm a chameleon. If you put me in a situation, I will blend in. I will survive. You know, I will pretend that I am just like you, no matter where I am. You know, that's one of the biggest patterns of my life, you know. So much so that the time came where I became a grown man and had no idea who I was because I had been spending years trying to be someone else. But anyway, so through those years, I managed to learn a trade. You know, people in AA, the Fellowship of AA, gave me jobs, and I learned a trade, learned how to feed myself and make money. I met a woman. I met several, but I met one that decided to marry me, or I should say decided to marry the representative that I put forth. You know, and what I mean by that is when I met this woman, a lot of people are laughing, so I understand. Yeah, a lot of people know what I'm talking about. Shame on you. But what I'm talking about is when I met her, I was so insecure of who I was, so I pretended to be the man that I thought she wanted me to be. And by the time we said I do, it was too late. I had taken yet another hostage of my life. You know, and we all know how that ended. You know, you can imagine. You know, it was a very short-lived marriage. And I would sit there in front of anybody who listened and belittle and berate that woman for all the things that I had done. You know, for all the things that I had done. And the fact of the matter is that it was my fault. They were my lies. It was my untreated alcoholism that destroyed everything that I had ever touched. You know, sober or drunk. But so anyway, when that failed, I managed to not pick up a drink for a few months after that. And then that time came where I had pushed everyone out of my life, where I didn't have the fellowship to fall back on. You know, and I'd never tried to enlarge a spiritual way of living, so I had no God to ask for help. You know, I had the foxhole prayers. Dear God, please get me out of this one. Please help me. Which I have said countless times. I have said that for countless times. But I had nothing substantial to fall back on. So when the temptation came, I said to hell with it and picked up a drink. Now, remember, I quit drinking when I was a teenager. So I really didn't drink in bars. You know, I didn't have the chance to actually taste different things. So when I went back out drinking, I walked into a bar and I ordered a double shot of Jack Daniels because that's what my father drank. And I remember I took a sip and it was awful. It was terrible. And I remember telling myself that there is no way I'm an alcoholic, because if I was an alcoholic, I would want to drink this. So I pushed it aside, all proud of myself, and said, excuse me, I'll have a beer. Yeah. And then ordered, I think, a Rumpelmann's, because that was like a little more fruity than, you know, like licorice, like candy, like I was used to drinking when I was a kid. But I remember being proud of myself. Like, you know, I'm not an alcoholic. I was born and raised in the wrong neighborhood. I grew up poor. I was never given the chances that other people were given. You know, I had a lot of bad friends when I grew up. You know, it was the influences that were in my life that caused all the problems back then. I'm not an alcoholic. You know, I was just a jerk. I lived on that idea for the next 5 years. You know, for the next 5 years and change, actually, of my life. And I finally figured out what they mean by alcohol is a subtle foe. Because 5 years had passed, and it seemed like a blink of an eye. You know, on the other hand, it seemed like an eternity. But the progression, I was the last one to see the progression of my alcoholism. Because I sat there at that bar, my first drink, after being dry for 7 years. And I remember having that pride. And I remember having that feeling, that conviction, that I didn't have a problem. And then, like that, 5 years later, I was as worse as I had ever been. Through those 5 years, I had managed to give away any ounce of humanity, any ounce of innocence that I may have had. In those 5 years, I went from being what the book says scarcely a potential alcoholic to a full-fledged alcoholic, to an alcoholic of the hopeless variety, you know, to the point where not only did my body need a drink, but my mind, my soul screamed for it on a daily basis. Also unaware of this, because it had become a pattern. Once again, I use that word, a pattern. My life is filled with patterns, you know. But anyway, I didn't realize any of these things were happening because I was at the bar every day, because I was anesthetized every day, because I had a drink or some kind of chemical in my body every day. Yeah. So I didn't realize how bad I needed it until the day came where I couldn't, I got laid off of work. I didn't have any money. Couldn't go to the bar. Ran out of other things I was allergic to. Didn't have that on hand. And you know, it's weird when you start getting the shakes and you start telling people, oh, I didn't eat today. That's why I had the shakes. I haven't had, you know, last thing I ate was, about an hour ago. I guess I should start eating something, you know. The lies that we tell ourselves, or I should say, excuse me, I'm sorry, the lies that I would tell myself just to continue living the life that I was living, you know. Through those years, I managed to, I don't know if you could say that I mended the relationships of my childhood, like my parents and siblings, you know, but I surely, they surely got a little bit better. But through those years when I went back out drinking, I managed to destroy all of them, you know. And even the ones that I didn't intentionally destroy, I would push them away. Because deep down inside, I knew what I was doing was wrong. And it was so difficult for me to even look myself in the mirror. How could my own mother want to look at me? My sisters, my brothers, my father, so on and so on. So I pushed everybody that ever cared about me out of my life, you know. Towards the end of my drinking, I remember, I tell this story frequently too. I was sitting in my apartment, or let me rephrase, I was sitting in my girlfriend's apartment that I had manipulated my way into, and looking at her, and this was about a year and a half relationship that we had, and for about a year of that year and a half, I couldn't stand the woman, and the woman couldn't stand me. You know, it was a mutual relationship, but a relationship of convenience, because we both drank the same I'll say. I won't say that she's an alcoholic or anything like that, but we surely drank the same. And we put up with each other because misery loves company, you know. But I remember sitting there through many years of just wanting to die, just wanting it to end, you know. I can't honestly say that throughout all of those years I wanted to die, but I surely wanted the life that I was leading to end one way or another, you know. And it never did, obviously. But I remember sitting there on the couch looking at her, looking at the bottle, looking at my drinks, looking at all the things around me, and just thinking, God, help me. Like, how did this happen? How did this happen? See, because in my mind, I was still living these lies. I was still living out these lies of my life, you know. I would tell myself, I was a husband. You know, only on paper, really. You know, I was a husband by law, but I never treated my wife the way she was supposed to be treated, you know. But I would tell myself, I was a husband. I would tell myself things like, I was a father. And I really wasn't that either. I mean, I helped bear a child, but I wasn't a father. I wasn't there for him the way a father should be, you know. Only a name, really. That's the only thing I gave my son, was a name, because I was too busy drinking, you know. I was too busy, you know, out and about living that lifestyle that comes with me being an alcoholic. You know, I would tell myself things like, you know, I had a business. No, I didn't. I had a truck with some ladders, you know, and a tool belt. And every once in a while, I would go do a job and make some money and tell myself these grandiose thoughts that I was somebody and on my way to be something, you know. But I remember sitting there telling myself all of these lies and thinking, what happened? What happened? And I prayed to God, dear God, please help me. Please help me. Now, the help that I was looking for was not waking up the next day. Every time I said that prayer towards the end of my drinking, I was praying that I wouldn't wake up the next day. That was the help that I thought that I needed. And towards the end of my drinking, I would also drink in pretty rowdy places, you know. I would pick fights with men that, for all intents and purposes, should have ended my life. And that was the reason why I would go there. I was trying to find ways of ending it all. And for some reason, it just never worked out. But anyway, you know, I just said the other night, every time I said that prayer, God help me, my life got worse and worse and worse and worse. You know, much like the book says, and this is repeated over and over and over again. And I remember by the time I got back into Alcoholics Anonymous, that God that I used to pray to, which I never had a relationship, always believed he was there, but never had that bond, you know. I had finally believed that he cared nothing for me, you know, that it was a mutual relationship. I care nothing for him. He cares nothing for me. And that's the way that it is. Yeah, but my last drunk was not a horrifying experience, although many of my drunks were. You know, towards the end of the last couple of years of my drinking, it was an awful, horrific life that I was leading. You know, that saying that we say that we're not bad people trying to get good, we're sick people trying to get better. In my case, that is not true. Yes, I was sick, wanting to get better, but there was something evil inside me. There was something awful living inside me, inside my soul, almost as if I traded my soul in, you know. But anyway, my last drunk was not that awful. I spent it with my younger sister and my brother-in-law and a few of our mutual friends, and it was actually, all intents and purposes, a nice time. Yeah, we went out bar hopping. Nobody got shot. Nobody got arrested. It was a good night. You know, it was a good night. And I woke up the next morning, and I think I had like $26 in my pocket. Let me rephrase. I had $26 in my name. It just so happened to be in my pocket. And I remember thinking, as I'm kissing my sister Mackenzie goodbye, I said, yeah, I'll see you around. I'm out of here. As I'm driving down the street, I'm thinking, where is the cheapest place that I could drink? You know, I'm thinking, all right, the VFW, nah, Sun's Italy, nah, I'm going through all these places. And as I'm driving down the street, I happen to look up, and I drive by the Lansdale Clubhouse. I keep driving, and for some strange reason, I went around the block as I'm thinking about where I'm going to drink. And I drove by, you know, coming up on that alley again. And I pulled in there, and I started shaking. Now, I wasn't shaking because I was detoxing. You know, I couldn't tell you why I started shaking right then. Yeah, But I parked my truck and I sat there for a few minutes because I needed a drink. But I didn't want to. Like, I didn't want to drink. And towards the end, I didn't want it. Every day would come by and I did not want to drink. But I needed to. You know, I needed to drink. Whether it be a physical thing, a mental thing, an emotional thing, I don't know. But every part of me screamed out for a drink. But I didn't want to live that way anymore. And I got out of my truck and I walked in the door, and it had been years since I sat at a meeting. And so when I got in there, I didn't really know anybody. And I told myself that if somebody doesn't walk through this door that I know, I'm leaving. And the moment I thought that, the moment, you know, boom, somebody walked in. And right after him, someone else did, you know. And they gave me that look of like, what the hell are you doing here? You know, and it's like, I wonder why, you know. Why am I here? Imagine that. But I remember I started to shake violently because I was afraid, you know. I was afraid of what was going to happen. My pride was in the way, you know, because of that self-centered person, that egotistical bastard that I was, pardon my language. I was full of pride. I was full of pride to come back and ask for help. You know, I didn't want to do that, but I was running out of options. You know, I was scared of the unknown because everything, I'd managed to turn everything in my life to hell, you know, and I didn't know what was going to happen after this. At least my life, as terrible as it was, I knew it. There was no changes in my life on a daily basis. There was no surprises. Things, you know, circumstances might change on any given day, but it all resulted in the same. You know, it was very painful, and I would never become anything. And I accepted these things about myself, that I was trash, and that was my life, you know. So I was afraid of the unknown. And, you know, at the meetings I attend, before they open it to general sharing, they ask, does anyone feel like drinking? And I immediately raised my hand and started to cry, you know, because I had had enough and I wanted help, but I just didn't know how. You know, through all those years of coming to AA, I never learned how. You know, I never stopped for a moment to get past myself to learn how. How do I live a better life? How do I become the man I've always wanted to be? How do I stop feeling the way I feel inside? The way I've been feeling since I was a little kid, which I might add, long before I picked up a drink. Yeah. But I did. I started to cry, and I couldn't tell you what I said. It's probably just a babbling idiot. Yeah, and of course you hear, keep coming back. It works. Which is not what I wanted to hear. I don't know what I wanted to hear. I think I wanted somebody to come up and tell me that it was going to be okay. Which, ironically enough, the first fella that talked to me told me that it wasn't. He said, how you doing today, Mike? I said, I'm sober. He goes, that might be all you get. I didn't like to hear that. You know, I wanted to hear everything was going to be fine. You know, everything's going to be okay from now on. He didn't lie to me. You know, he didn't lie to me. You know, because that's all I got that day. And for many days after that, that's all I got. I'd love to sit here and tell you that I learned my lesson from all the years prior of doing absolutely nothing but attending meetings. But I didn't. Because for the first 6 months of my sobriety, if you could call it, all I did was didn't drink and go to meetings. And I suffered the consequences yet again. You know, we talk about our bottoms in AA. I hit my bottom 6 months sober. I hit that physical bottom that brought me in, you know, to the rooms of AA, but I hit that bottom that counted without having a drink. And what I mean by that is, you know, I was talking about the kind of person that I was when I was drinking. It's very difficult to be that guy without alcohol. It's very difficult to live that life without the ability, not so much the ability because I always had the ability, but with making the choice that I was no longer going to anesthetize myself. You know, every day I had to wake up knowing who I was, knowing what I had done. You know, every day I had to wake up and live with the pain of being me. And around 6 months sober, I remember really contemplating killing myself because the pain was great. The pain was far too great. And at the same time I was going through all this pain, there were people put in my life that would, my one friend Chris, every week he'd ask me, what are you doing Tuesday? I'd say, nothing. Why? Because there's this big book study down in Philadelphia that I go to. You'll love it. Da, da, da. And all of a sudden, after he told me what it was, I had something to do. You know what I mean? You know what? I forget. I got to walk my buddy's dog or something. You know? But when the time came where I couldn't deal with it anymore, I asked for help. And I went with him. And that was the first place that I ever heard. Now, I'm not saying that people weren't trying to tell me what the message was before this, but it was the first place I ever heard the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it was the first time. I walked in the room, and it happened to be my future sponsor's house. He would have this meeting every Tuesday night in his house, in his living room. And then his living room, it grew to a living room and a dining room. And then in time, it was living room, dining room, and then part of the kitchen, you know, in a little row home out in Port Richmond. I walked in, and there was a bunch of guys sitting in this, if you can call it a circle. And there was a few gentlemen, let me rephrase, there was a few guys sitting up front of the house, you know, with their big books open. And it was school. It was a class. There were three men sitting up front with their big books open, and they were telling us what the words meant. They weren't asking us our opinion about what they meant. They were telling us what they meant. And they handed me a highlighter and a pen and said, when I tell you to highlight something, you highlight it. When I tell you to write down a definition of a word, you write it down. And by this time, all my scorecards had read zero. And I don't mean to be, you know, taking words out of the big book or anything of my own, but it's true. I had nothing left but to do this or kill myself. So I said, okay. And I started to underline things and highlight them and write things down. And then all of a sudden, I started to ask questions. And for the first time in my life, I had hope. I had some kind of hope. Because I don't know if you've ever been down in a neighborhood like that, but a place like that is what I like to call the front lines of alcoholism and drug addiction. You know, because right outside that door, as we're having our little AA get-together, people are selling heroin on the street corner. People are stumbling out of corner stores with quarts and 40s and six-packs in their hands. Right outside, God bless you, right outside that door. And yet the men that were sitting in front of me were teaching me a way that I didn't have to do that anymore. They were teaching me a better way of life. So that's what I like to call the front lines of AA down there. But I went religiously every week, and I finally asked this man to be my sponsor. And he says, do you know what a sponsor is? And of course, I said, yeah, you're supposed to, like, you know, help me out through, like, all this stuff. That was my definition. Help me out through all of this stuff. And he said, no. He goes, my job is to take your hand and put it in God's and walk away. And the only way that I know how to do that is through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous that is found in this book. He said that this book is not just a good read. This book is a textbook for good living. He said, you remember when you went to school when you were a kid and they would give you textbooks like math class when you learned that 2 + 2 = 4? He goes, do you ever remember raising your hand and giving your opinion on that? Well, then don't give it here. Yeah. And that made sense to me. Yeah, that made sense to me. It was class. Much like I was learning math and grammar, which, by the way, I didn't learn too well. In school when I was a kid, I was learning how to be a better man. As you know, in my sponsor's house, going through the book. But he told me, as we go through the steps, he said that step one is a death sentence. Before we went through step one, he asked me, do you believe that you're an alcoholic? And I said, yes. And he said, no. Do you truly believe that you're an alcoholic? And he started to ask me questions about when I drink and how I drink and how my life is. And the answer stayed the same, that I'm an alcoholic. And he told me that, good, step one for you is a death sentence. Yeah. He said, now knowing what you are, that you're an alcoholic, if you just don't drink and go to meetings, you're going to die. Yeah, that doesn't work. He said, there are many types of drinkers, but you're an alcoholic. So all of that coming to meetings and not having to do the 12 steps does not apply to you. Yeah, I said, okay. Now, I work construction, and he's a mason. So as we went through the second step, he told me that this step doesn't ever mention God. It's just talking, just the short version, doesn't mention God. It just talks about a power greater than you. You know, and like I had said earlier, by the time I got to AA, I was kind of harsh on God. I thought God was kind of harsh on me, so it was hard for me to swallow that. He said, don't worry about that right now. He goes, a power greater than yourself is real simple. He goes, you take you by yourself. You're alone. You're screwed. you're screwed. Because now it's you and me standing here together. He said, mathematically alone, two is a power greater than one. I could understand that. You know, I could dig that. You know, that was easy for me to comprehend. I said, okay. And he also showed me where it said that step two is the cornerstone, you know, on top of that foundation that we have just laid in step one. That realization that we are alcoholic and cannot drink. But that alone will avail me nothing. Step two is the cornerstone. You know, step two is where I start to learn a better way, where I start to give up my way of thinking. And I'm willing, at least willing, to try to take somebody else's or something else's. I could do that. He said, all right, remember that God stuff I was telling you about, don't worry about? All right, well, this is step three. You got to worry about it now. I told him as I sat there probably for 20 minutes and blamed God for everything in my life. I love my sponsor. He saved my life that by no stretch of the imagination. I love him because he would sit there and listen to me and then tell me I was wrong. Yeah. No matter what I said, he would listen to me or at least hear me and then tell me I was wrong. Yeah. He told me that unless I enlarge my spiritual life, I will die. I will inevitably pick up a drink and I will die. You know, he said that step three is the keystone, you know, to which we are building that arch. And when we walk through it, we will come through a different man, a man that does not have to fear alcohol, a man that does not have to fear the world that I was living in. That if I continue to try to put these principles in my life with action, that I never have to be that person that I walked in as. And I dug that, too. You know, I dug that. And I listened to him because here was a guy, short in stature. You know, everybody's short to me. I'm 6'5". But he was just like me. He's covered in tattoos. He's a Mason. He talks like I do, you know. But he had everything I wanted, you know. He had confidence. He had peace in him, you know. Not to mention, I was in his home. I'd never had a home of my own. Like all the material things I wanted, you know. But more importantly, he was all right with who he was, and I was not. So I listened to him, you know. He told me that step four must be done immediately. He showed me in the book how, like, all of those things that you hear, I love hearing people talk about. Your first year of sobriety, don't worry about the steps. Just go to meetings. Don't drink. You know, get a sponsor, do that stuff, but don't worry about doing the steps. Don't get well too quick. You know, I love that one. That's one of my personal favorite ones. Don't get too well too quick. Yeah. He told me that nowhere in this book does it ever say that. And he showed me many, many different pages where it says the exact opposite of that. You know, where it says the only time that we wait to do the steps is for the alcoholic that is still jittery and befogged and needs hospital and medical attention. You know, but that only lasts for a little while. You know, a friend of mine says, he said a guy asked him when to do the steps. He says, when you stop throwing up. You know? That's when you start the steps, you know. And I agree with that, you know. I agree with that. Nowhere in this book does it tell me to wait to get better. In fact, it tells me the opposite. So I jumped right on step four, you know. And I can honestly say for the first time I was as honest as I possibly could have been when I did my first four step. You know, I wrote down everything. As minuscule as I thought it meant, I wrote it down. I wrote down stuff about when I was 13 years old, some kid that sucker punched me walking down the street, and I was still pissed off about the whole thing. Yeah, but I wrote it down. I didn't think it had anything to do with anything, but I wrote it down. Yeah, and I immediately did my fifth step. It was a real cool opportunity. I did my fifth step down at Cape May. It was at the Cape May Roundup. And we sat down in his hotel room, and we go through it. And he started to show me that all of the things, see, once again, I will reiterate how smart I've always thought I was, how cocky, you know. I always thought that I knew what my character defects were. Like, one of my character defects is that I'm a thief. That is not a character defect. That is a byproduct of a character defect. You know, I'm a liar. That's a character defect. No, it's a byproduct of a character defect. You know, this is how I thought, you know. So when I sat down my fifth step and telling my sponsor exactly what was wrong with me, you know, once again, he'd listen and tell me I was wrong. He started to point out things that, my character defects are fear. You know, most of my life has been fear-based. He showed me some of my character defects are not only am I selfish and self-centered, but I'm inconsiderate, that I don't care about other people's feelings, that it's all about me. My life can be summed up in three words, me, me, me. And it hasn't been really working out that well, you know. When he showed me these things, I'll share briefly part of my fifth step. I always held great great animosity towards my father. You know, the man, I might add, that tried to help me throughout my entire life. You know, but such animosity, such hatred toward him. Looking back, I know it's just because I was very sick. You know, but I remember sitting down with him, and my sponsor, that is, going through my fifth step, and having in the back of my mind, I got this one. You know, all the stuff he's telling me is my fault, I got this. You know, I went through a nasty childhood, beatings, all that crazy stuff. I was a victim. I was a victim. So I tell him all this good stuff about my old man, and he goes, when did you leave home? I said, I was 15. He goes, how old are you? I said, I'm 30. He goes, so you mean to tell me for the last 15 years of your life, you've been harboring a childhood resentment with every ability to go seek help, whether it be a psychiatrist, a therapist, Alcoholics Anonymous that you were in for God knows how long. You had all the opportunity to get rid of it, and you held on to it like a child. And I remember thinking, well, when you put it like that, it really doesn't hold much weight in this conversation. But by telling me things like that, it showed me that I had a part in every aspect of my life. I had a part in every resentment I had ever had. I had a part in anything and everything I had ever done and even just experienced in my life. I had a part, you know, and what did I do with that part? That's what we're getting down to. When I did my fifth step, he told me to take that hour, like the book tells me, you know, to reflect and see if I skimped on any of the steps prior to that, you know, and I did. He goes, now, I'm going to tell you, you know, you're supposed to take this hour. You'll probably make 15 minutes, you know, of being perfectly still and quiet. If you're good, you'll probably make 15 minutes. Don't worry about it. Do the best you can, you know. And he wasn't really that right. I think I made 20, you know, but he was close. But as I sat in that room and started to think about my life, you know, unknowingly, I might add, I was doing my sixth step. You know, I was looking at all these things that were on paper in front of me. Now, I didn't know that I was doing my sixth step until I opened up the next page and realized what a sixth step was. You know, I was looking down at all these things. I was looking down at the columns that I wrote, and then I was looking at the column that we wrote that he helped me with, you know, to see a lot of those patterns I was talking about, you know, of my life. And for the first time in my life, I didn't want any of it. Like, I honestly didn't want any of it, and I was open-minded to having it be taken from me. You know, and that God that I told you that I was having problems with and still believed in, but I didn't necessarily believe that he believed in me, I got on my knees and I begged him to take this from me. I begged him. And I swear to you, this is when my miracle happened. My hand to God, if I'm lying, I'm dying. And the moment that I asked that it was taken from me, I had felt a peace as I've never known before. That is the God's honest truth of my life. I have never felt it before that. I can tell you I have felt it since. Now, that being said, a few hours after that, you know, when all of my character defects were taken from me and I was rendered as white as snow, a few hours after that, somebody said the wrong thing to me. It's the little dance they had at the Cape May Roundup, and boy, did we have words. You know, and all that stuff that God took from me, right back, you know. And that's when I realized that it's by the actions of the next step that I have a chance of keeping those things at bay. You know, I was told things like God will remove them from me once, but it's my job to keep them gone. You know, and I honestly don't want to be that man anymore. You know, my eighth step was real easy. I had it when I wrote my fourth. You know, I sat down with my sponsor and I had to do a little bit of tweaking. I had to figure out which ones could be done now, which ones could be done later, and which ones I wasn't real sure about. Yeah. But then again, he told me, it doesn't matter if I'm sure about them, they got to be done. You don't have to do them today, but they got to be done. You know, it's a direct amends. It's none of this phone call crap either. Yeah. And he told me things like, an amends is not saying that you're sorry. You know, which I didn't know. You know, I really thought, like, if you really meant it, you know, if you were really sorry, that was good enough. You know what I mean? I tried. I said I was sorry. They didn't accept it. Oh, well, you know, what can you do? No, that is not an amends, he told me. He said, there's a few parts of making an amends. He says, a very important part, when you make an amends, you go up to the person and you tell them that you were wrong. Not that you were sorry, that you were wrong. A little more important part, you tell them what you were wrong about. You know, specifics. Yeah. And the most important part is you ask not only for their forgiveness, But if you can make it right, if there's anything that you can do to make it right, that's the amends. That's the action, you know, what you do to make it right. I was afraid of that. And, you know, looking back, you know, looking at some of the amends that still have to be done, sometimes I still get afraid of that. But I know that I have to do it. And I know that what I get from it is amazing. There's no other word to describe it. The feeling that I get from doing the right thing, the feeling that I get from trying at least to make right what I had wronged, is amazing. I wish I was a poet that I could explain it better to you. You know, but those are the only words I have for you. But so I launched out, you know, and started making my amends, and immediately went through my list and said, okay, mom's number one. Because no matter what happens, mom's going to say it's okay. Yeah, I forgive you. I love you. It's a good, you know, it's a good start. I went out, and sure enough, mom, it's okay. I love you. Just be a good boy and all that. Yeah, and but that was what I needed, because it gave me, like, you know, the courage I needed to continue. And then I did. That was the most important word I just said. I continued. I didn't stop. I continued, you know, and I still continue to this day. Like I said, I'm not finished, but I continue, you know. Sat down at the 10th step, and my sponsor, I remember him telling me that there are promises. You know, at my home group, Lansdale Clubhouse, we read the, which is one of my pet peeves, they call them the AA promises. What they really are, the 9th step promises that we read. But he told me that there are promises at the end of every action step. And he showed me where they were in the book. You know, and when I got to number 10, he showed me the 10 step promises. And I want to share them with you if you don't know what they are. Look at that. I opened right up to it. Imagine that. It says, "And we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol. For by this time, sanity will have returned. We will seldom..." Yes, there are many colors in my book. "We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally, and we will find that this has happened automatically. We will see that our new attitude toward liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That is the miracle of it. We are not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we have been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky, nor are we afraid. That is our experience. That is how we react so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition." Not only is that last sentence a promise, it is also a warning. I don't get to receive these things on a daily basis unless I continue. You know, a friend of mine says things like sobriety has a 24-hour expiration date, and that the things that I did yesterday have no weight on today. Every day is a new day that I have to continue fighting for, you know. I get to continue fighting. I can't do this by myself. I come to meetings. I'm grateful because most of the time I come to meetings is because I try to give back so freely what was given to me. It is very rare these days that I come to a meeting and share my problems, because I can honestly say that my problems have been more than halved since I started to do these things. You know, but I do these things with the help of God. Sometimes these things are done because of God, in my belief, because God kind of only knows I can't do them. You know, I have that relationship with a higher power today that I choose to call God. You know, I know what it's like. He is with me all the time, from the moment I wake up to the moment I go to bed, and then some. My thoughts throughout the day, don't get me wrong, I am not made of cotton candy and bubble gum, and I surely don't float into the friggin' room, you know. But my thoughts on a daily basis are always, what would I do to please my Creator? Now, I fail at that every day because I'm human, but I try. Every day, I try with all the courage and strength that I can muster. I try. And the reason why I do that, it started off as fear. I was afraid to pick up a drink again. The reason why I do these things today are because I enjoy them, or because the life that was given to me is unlike any other I have ever lived. You know, that peace that I was talking about that my sponsor has was given to me through the help of my sponsor by God. Don't get me wrong. life, as another friend of mine says, life gets lifey. At any given moment, I could be thrown a curveball, and all of that spiritual, those spiritual things I'm talking about, get put on pause until I can, you know, you can hear that. For just so you know, that's the noise of when my head comes out of my butt. Yeah, it gets put on pause, but I'm always, always seeking. Always seeking the next right thing to do. Because I know that if I fall away from that, slowly but surely, things that I used to be, things that I used to do will become acceptable. And if that happens, I will pick up a drink. And if I pick up a drink, I will die. All the things worthwhile in my life will be taken from me first, and then I will die. And I refused to let that happen. The greatest tool I have today in my life is sponsorship. When I first started doing the steps, the greatest tool I had then was sponsorship, but it has changed since then. You know, sponsorship to me is what I give to other men. You know, I stress that, men. You know, I have no business sponsoring a woman, you know, for many different reasons that we will not get into at this moment in time. But I have no business sponsoring or even trying to with a woman. But the men that I sponsor, it's the greatest tool that I earn, because every time I sit down with another alcoholic who feels the way that I felt when I first walked in, not only can I empathize and sympathize with the man, but I go through this book that, as my friend over here mentioned, that is awfully colorful. You know, it's colorful for a reason, because I highlighted these things that saved my life. Every time I sit down with them and try to give to them what was given to me, I'm reminded of what I have to do. You know, I'm reminded of what I have to do. I enjoy it. I'm good at this. Who would have thunk it? I'm good at this life thing, you know. I enjoy my life. I love my life. I love me today. You know, that is a far cry from the shell of a man that walked through the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous on June 24th, you know, a year and a half ago. But if I could leave you with anything, it's this. If you're new to AA, I know what you're going through. I know the pain that you have in your heart. You know, I know the shakes that you have and not being comfortable in your own skin, and there is a way out of that. There is a solution, you know. In the doctor's opinion, it says, although we work out our solution in the spiritual as well as the altruistic plane, for years I've been working on my problems. There's a solution found in these rooms. There's a solution found in this book, you know. If you're new, it's not going to be okay unless you put work into your recovery. If you just sit here and rest on your laurels, you will reap it. But if you actually do what people say their suggestions, I beg to differ. If you follow these few simple rules, these essential requirements, your life will get better. You will find a peace that you have never known. That is a promise that I have seen be fulfilled in many people's lives. If you are not new to AA, and you do not know what I'm talking about, then shame on you. If you have been coming to AA and you have time and you have not been through the steps and you have not helped another alcoholic and you have not helped save their lives, then shame on you. Because that's what this is about. My sponsor told me one of the last things he said after we finished my first round of the steps is, now you're in the business of saving lives. I have been in the business of anything but for a very long time. You know, it is the greatest joy that I get in life today. So if you're new, I beg you to stay. And if you're not, I beg you to continue. You know, because there are a lot of people out there dying. And I'm not one of them today. Actually, let me share.